Off the ball on News Talk. Thanks to Air. Catch all the sports you love free on the Air Sport Pack with Air Broadband.
Keith Andrews has joined us in studio. How are you?
Evening, Nathan.
How are you?
I'm still not great. I'm not going to lie to you.
I was walking out of the Aviva Stadium on Tuesday evening. I wasn't particularly happy myself. Nobody was particularly happy. And I see some steam coming out of the ears of Keith Andrews as he marches out of one of the many lounges he was making a few quid on the side in.
I was not.
I've never seen him look as angry. I didn't know at this stage he had got off on one. On Sky.
Yeah, we were in the press conference room sort of listening to a couple of clips, and there was a sort of a 30-second Andrews viral pumped into the room at one point. The word torture just gets you going. But, I mean, it was a night for like raw feeling, wasn't it? How could you be Irish and be anything other than suffering some sort of deep type of emotion, be it, you know, either anger or just like sort of desolation and sort of...
Well, if you're not, I said the day I retired that I go back to being a fan, and I am a fan. I think certainly you two know how passionate I am about it. And after Saturday's performance, there was a lot of tripe in certain newspapers and certain shows where I thought, these are so off the mark here in terms of the criticisms that's getting levelled at the performance. I was impressed and positive after the first leg in terms of where we were in the overall tie. But Tuesday, I couldn't believe what I was watching.
You described it as pure torture. You went on to say it was gung-ho football. Thought the first half was silly in terms of how we set up. We highlighted Eriksen, top of the show, as the key player. Kept him so quiet on Saturday. It really beggars belief what they've done. It was tactically, you were asked by the presenter. You said clueless. Absolutely clueless. Have you watched it back?
Yeah, I watched it back on Wednesday, and thoughts don't particularly change in terms of the Diamond. I just feel against their players, and what I wanted from the performance on Saturday going into Tuesday was similar type of performance, but just in a more advanced area of the pitch. So we bring the game up to them 20, 30 yards together. So we still deny that space for Eriksen, for Sisto when he rolls inside, because they have got good players in those areas. They haven't got blistering pace up front, although they are sharp. So we could have kept a sensibly high-ish line.
That was the point Kenny Cunningham was making on Off the Ball AM on Wednesday morning, that I think people think the formation that we use on Saturday night is a very defensive formation. It's only defensive because we sit so far back. Kenny was making that exact point. If you just play 30 yards further up the pitch, it can become quite an attacking formation.
And if you do get caught a little bit deeper at times, which you will, because they will get better possession and string those 2-3 passes to unlock it a little bit. You want to go look to Vienna. When we have a bit of quality on the ball, when we have the ball relatively deep, 1-3 passes, James McLean's true. We just didn't show the quality in the first leg. That's where we obviously needed to get better. But the system for me, didn't like it right from the off. There was, when you're at the game, as you used to, where it's different when you're watching on the telly. When you're at the game, you can see the space that they had to go and play. And Harida hit the nail on the head. He thanked us for playing that system and giving them the space that they wanted.
So they had space in pretty much every area of the pitch. But also, what the Diamond did was, particularly as you say, when you're at the game and you're able to get an overview, as you're looking at the Diamond, in the middle of that Diamond, every single time, is Christian Eriksen standing there. And at one stage when they went off on a counter-attack, they were streaming forward and Eriksen was at full sprint, and he was suddenly closing in on Harry Arter at the edge of the area, and suddenly he stalled his run. So again, he found himself smack bang in the middle of that Diamond, where when he eventually picked up the ball, he had 7-8 yards of space, plenty of time to pick out a pass, which he just didn't have on Saturday. It just beggars belief that was the game plan. It just seems wrong in so many ways.
Yeah, because we've played the Diamond formation before and there's been success at times with it, or certainly maybe in terms of results, but there was personnel on the pitch that seemed to quite enjoy it. I mean, I think the Bosnia game, it was at home, it was a Diamond that night, but it was Murphy and Walters sort of from the front, so they were aggressive. You know, everything, as you mentioned, Keith, the game was played in the Bosnian half. There was a real sense of squeeze, and Wes also played that night too. You do look at the other night and you would think, was that approach, was that system picked with the way Denmark played in mind, or was it just Let's go back to the
what's
Diamond
got a success?
Because I mean, we had a few issues with their fullbacks getting forward the other night, and when you play that system, you see Myler and Brady were getting sucked inside, and every time, and it looked like, I mean, Denmark were intelligent; they could sense
it.
Yeah,
so in theory,
the runs that they made were sensible.
York strong in the middle of the pitch, but what was happened was because Larsen was a threat in the first game, has been all doubt, felt asleep on that occasion, and Sisto, who is probably their second, third best player, I think. He's rolling inside, so Cyrus Christie's unsure what's happening. Myler, who's on the right hand side of the diamond, is having to go out. And you're right, then if they don't go wide and Myler's out, then the space is there again for Eriksen.
Do you think the players knew what their roles were? Was there clarity in the roles? And I'm talking about players who, by and large, have been in this squad for 4 years under Martin O'Neill, who've been part of this campaign. That in the playoff, in our 12th game of the campaign, at the start of that game, do you think David Myler knew exactly what his role was? What Robbie Brady, did he know? Did Jeff Hendrick know exactly what Martin O'Neill wanted from him?
Probably not. It's such a tight turnaround in those few days in terms of getting any type of quality training. The training that would have been done or should have been done would have been on the side of video analysis or a walkthrough of the system. But Martin is notorious in terms of his team selection, how late he leaves it. I mentioned to the Sky lads, when the lads were on the pitch, they arrived, they were saying, you know, will they know the team? No, I don't think they will.
You see, I don't think a lot of people who follow the team and a lot of people who are listening fully understand this or fully accept this, that it's some sort of media myth that we've thrown out there to undermine Martin O'Neill when we go, he only names the team beforehand. And no. They're working on stuff during training. The players know. All right, he may not have officially named the team. No. The players, quite by and large, find out the team 1 hour beforehand. The odd time a player might get a nod on a Friday or the day beforehand and go, you're going to be starting, or when they arrive. But quite often players have made their competitive debut and literally didn't find out till he read out a list of names beforehand.
Yeah, we made the comment on Saturday, actually, with someone like Callum O'Dowda playing in that magnitude of game. That's probably not a bad thing. So he's not sleeping or he's just stewing on it all night or all the whole day over in Copenhagen. But in general, I certainly wouldn't have liked it. And I believe that's the way things happen. But what Martin's reasons are, I'm not so sure. It's very Brian Clough-esque. And I think we all probably would agree that his management style is from that type
from
of
that era. Do you think he could have corrected it during the first half? Because it's something I was thinking about the other day. He actually had the personnel on the pitch to shift it to the system that he had. Just with
McLean going wide.
Yeah. You know, Brady out in the right or Hendrick, whatever way you wanted to shift it. That to
me, Myler back a bit more.
It's like the problem solving within the game that there were those couple of chances and yet they persevered with it. That's the frustrating
100%.
Thing.
And you know, literally within 3, 4, 5 minutes of the goal, they just started to get into this rhythm and it was worrying because what we had was Daryl Murphy obviously can't get around the pitch as much as he used to. So you want two split strikers in theory looking after the back four. And then as the fullback goes, they pass that fullback onto one of the tip of the diamond. James McLean, as we know, I was looking at James McLean in the first 15 minutes thinking he's not going to last 60 minutes here with the amount of running he was doing, but to very little avail. Change the system. Myself and Big Niall in the box, we're going, please change the system. They are getting way too comfortable and confident in the way they're getting at our back four so easily. For me, it was very evident just to change it.
A lot of the questions after the game, maybe in defence of Martin O'Neill, have been about the quality of players that he has, and looking at the way Denmark were able to control the game, they were able to get it down. Pretty much every single one of their outfield players was seemed comfortable in possession of the ball, able to pick out a pass, didn't lose the ball at all, and we just don't have that. And I thought it was very noticeable that, like, the stuff you see off the training ground that happens during a match, the little triangles that happened between the fullback, the centre midfielder, and maybe the left winger. And you do them 4 or 5 times, quick triangles, and then you step inside. Denmark did that time and time again, and they just moved away from Ireland. When Ireland were doing their little triangles, Harry Arthur would give it to David Myler, it'd be a yard in front of him, he'd stretch slightly, he might knock it on to James McLean, who then would stretch again, and it might go back to Harry Arthur, somebody might give it away. That doesn't happen when you watch Harry Arthur at club level. It doesn't happen when you watch James McLean at club level. It doesn't happen with Brady, Hendrick. All of them are able to play football and to do a job. Why is it that on Tuesday night, they all looked so nervous every time they got the ball? well, are so uncomfortable.
Take Harry Arthur, who I believe has a real culture shock when he comes and plays for us, because we'll have all seen Bournemouth play and the way they set up. It's sometimes they play too much in the wrong areas and they've been punished for that, but they have a certain way of playing. The same with the Burnley lads. They know exactly what the other player on the pitch is going to do. I've often made the reference to the Roy Hodgson West Brom side I was in, where we were a mid to lower Premier League team. Training every day wasn't particularly enjoyable because it was so regimental. He wanted phases of play. The right back gets on the ball, here's his options. It became clockwork, absolute clockwork.
Was that the same under Trapp?
Yeah, yes, in a different type of way. Obviously, Roy was keeping the ball, passing the ball, options. Where with Trapp, we knew, even if you didn't play, if I was injured and whoever came in, they knew how to play. I wasn't going and showing for a ball off Kevin at left back or whoever it was. I was already getting on my bike, and look, we didn't agree with large parts of it, but we knew what we were doing. Whereas I look at Jeff Hendrick, I look at Robbie Brady, and especially Robbie Brady, when he's getting on the ball, he's trying to make things. Nothing's becoming natural. Nothing's just easy. It's as if you're having to conjure things up.
Are those players, and we were talking about this outside earlier, about the coaching those players have received. So they've come through the system, Hendrick, Brady. Are they overcoached? Has their individuality, their creativity been taken out of them throughout football? So at Burnley, Sean Dyche knows what he wants them to do. They follow orders very well. They know their position. They know when they pick it up in the centre circle, whether to go left, whether to go right. That the freedom they're given by Martin O'Neill doesn't actually suit them. That they haven't been brought up in that sort of culture.
I don't buy into that. I've said before that I've been disappointed with the level of coaching and management I've had in my career. I wanted more. In my early parts of my career, I would very much look in the mirror and say some of that was my fault. But overall, the level of coaching I thought was poor. I think you've only got to look at some of the top coaches in Europe, the top coaches in the Premier League. They're coaches. They make players better, especially if you're with that manager for a sustained period of time. I think when we look at Ancelotti, who's left Bayern Munich, that's probably one of the reasons that he left. He wasn't making the players, the group, better. He was relying on them to do it. And I suppose in certain ways, it's a little bit of an old school style of management. And in certain aspects, it worked depending on your dressing room. And certain other aspects, it certainly doesn't work. But I think it's more going into the lines of a coach style manager for me.
Yeah, because I mean, you've been involved in coaching at sort of underage levels. I mean, can you send players onto the pitch at that level and just say to a more creative player, just go on and get on the ball? Which seems to be an element of some of the instructions that are being given to this Irish team. You know, just go out there and head it, or get out there and go on the ball. That, I can't imagine it's something that you would encounter in your world.
Clear instructions, trying to limit it, especially with younger players, so be as concise as you can. And the other thing that I did learn from being involved with international teams on the coaching side with our underage teams was the time that you have is so precious. You have to maximise every single hour in the day. And with younger players, we could bombard them a little bit more with video analysis. Senior players, more set in their ways, they would be more reluctant to that, I would imagine. But no, you've got to be very, very precise in terms of what you show. I think that goes all the way through. You'd be looking at, as you should be, as the coach, the manager, where are we getting this number 10? Look, for instance, our number 9 is going to come short. We want you to run in behind. Or as our 8 bombs forward, you drop a little bit deep. But you've got to give them some kind of little snippet of information.
But could those players then on Tuesday not have managed things a bit better on the pitch too, though? Could that be a criticism? I know that the system was...
Definitely.
You know, you think about Paris and these games where players maybe take things into their own hands to a point that... Could the players have still to take some share of the blame for what happened there? You know?
Look, I think the players would be the first to hold their hands up. And that's why I haven't actually come out and criticised any player. But collectively, the players didn't play well enough. They will know that. I've been in games like that where things have gone and players have got together and we've kind of gone and produced a performance where we've all gone, look, we've given everything we've got. But I've also been on the flip side of that. For instance, Germany, when we got absolutely popped off the park, where I'll tell you right now, I ran just as much that night, but for whatever reason you're chasing shadows or you're not quite there or it's just not in unison. So it's frustrating, but the lads would be devastated for about the other night in terms of their individual performances and mistakes.
Those bad defeats, so you think back to Euro 2012, you took your frustration out in the last game, but the game against Germany, what was the reaction in those closing minutes from the players on the pitch towards each other? Because it was very noticeable from actually quite early in the game that the Irish players last night were really at each other. They weren't supportive of each other. It didn't seem that every misplaced ball started on a little rant and a back and forth. Is that just something that can naturally happen, or is that again a sign of some sort of uncertainty within the players?
Well, just frustration and what could have been. As soon as that third goal goes in, probably all know that's it. You know, they're not going to get to a World Cup. It's the end of an era for certain players. I'd imagine that certain ones will retire in the coming weeks and months. And for even some of the younger players, they may not get another opportunity. And that's what I was so frustrated about the other night and disappointed with, that I felt it was an opportunity. Like, these don't come knocking all the time. They really don't. And I do think there's going to be a bit of a transition with this side in the next year to two. And I don't think 2020 is a given.
Yeah, 11 players over the age of 30. It'll be interesting to see what happens between now and the start of the qualifiers proper in 18 months' time. The other part of this, and again, it's a constant theme with Martin O'Neill, and we laugh about it at times when you have former players who were successful with him, was the preparation around the set pieces and the first goal and only one player going out, despite Denmark either having gone short or certainly having had two players out there for pretty much every corner kick in Copenhagen. It seems as though the plan was, maybe they had worked on it, but the plan was to only go with one player for those short corners. Was that just madness, or?
Well, when I would look at Denmark, and I wouldn't have seen a fraction of what Martin and his management team and his analysis side of the department would have seen, I instantly think, I don't want them playing it short because of the type of players they have. Why would you give them easy possession that close to your goal, which was the whole reason we set up in the way we did on Saturday and we frustrated them? So I would fancy our chances with direct delivery into the box with the strength and the power that we do have. It's been a running theme, though. Corner kicks in particular has been an issue for us in this campaign.
Well, before, going back to Scotland.
Exactly. So it was too easy. I was quite critical of Jeff Hendrick. I felt he should have given Harry Arthur a little bit more protection in terms of covering Sisto, but he got attracted to Eriksen. Sisto does Arthur too much, but I think it was Delaney who nicked in. No one tracked him from the edge of the box. It was just poor all round, and yeah, it's certainly one that you could have avoided.
What's going on with Jeff Hendrick in an Ireland jersey? We just have not seen anything like the performances he put in at Euro 2016. Now, I know Burnley's probably been solid. He's had good games. He's had games where he's been anonymous. But in an Irish jersey, he's looked lost. Is that down to Martin O'Neill again not knowing his best position? Jeff Hendrick really not knowing what O'Neill wants from him?
Well, his best position for me certainly isn't as a number 10 with his back to goal. And ironically, at the moment, he's playing that position for Burnley, which I'm going to see on Saturday. I just hope he reverts back to a number 8 style. With the license to get forward, we seen him in the second half as the holding midfielder for us. That doesn't suit him for me either. I was so impressed with his kind of the way, and he got to where he was in his career, and the pinnacle being the Euros, because the apprenticeship that he had at Derby was, I would say, near perfect, because he had Clough in charge of him, who we would imagine, and what I've heard, is a little bit old school, instills old school values in him. And then he had Steve McLaren, who I think added a little bit more polish to him, and it gave him more of an understanding of tactics, and his game in possession came on so much under Steve McLaren. But I do think this campaign has bypassed him, and I put him on a pedestal last year at the Euros, like most of us did, but himself and Robbie Brady, as these were our new era, along with Seamus, along with Shane Duffy. These were going to be the driving forces, and it simply hasn't happened for him in this campaign.
Like, what is the shape of the Irish midfield going forward then? Because we have Harry Arthur, we have quite a few central players, James McCarthy possibly. We don't know where his career is at, just with the injuries he's had. Like, where is the role for Hendrick? Is it more, you know, the right side where
he's
played?
Some of his best
games
have been on the right for us, actually, haven't they? And it suited him to a degree in the way we play, and we've seen John Walters do that type of role. But I think it's actually a position where we've got good options. Everybody fit and everybody playing well at club level. You've just named those three: James McCarthy, Harry Arthur, Jeff Hint, good, solid Premier League players. So in that position, I think it's just getting the right balance between them. And for me, it's not with a number 10. It's a holding one and two number 8s, box-to-box, power, energy, but with the bravery to get on the ball and get us dictating play, which Hendrick and Arthur are capable of doing.
You've been involved with the under-17s. You know the underage setup, and there is going to be a lot of focus on what's coming through. The under-21s have had a decent campaign so far. You look at the midfield of Cullen and Rice and would have hopes that they could go and develop, though they're still both 18 and maybe quite a bit away from establishing themselves as first-choice players. The work done by Rude Doctor, are they still playing 4-3-3 at every underage team?
Not set in stone. I think the... depending on personnel, there's that license to tweak things depending on the players you have at your disposal within that age group. But the majority will play that 4-3-3, whether it's a number 6 and 2-8 or a more traditional 4-2-3-1. I think the work that's going on in the rage is very, very good. But what people will, I would imagine, be saying is, well, if we're playing in a set way underage, why can that not transfer into the senior team? Well, Martin O'Neill might not be here in 2, 3, 4, 5 years, so it's always going to be very hard to do it in a way that's going to suit a particular manager's style at senior level. For me, technically, they are very, very good players underage, but we, when I was there, we'd like to instill that passion, that drive that you're going to need to play in a green jersey if you get to that senior level. And from what I've seen, it was there in abundance. I think the work, the level of coaching that does go on at underage levels is very, very good.
The fact that the international manager, the senior international manager, will change on a fairly regular basis, every 4 or 5 years, probably at most, is that a reason not to have a set system? That you're basically working week in, or probably month in as it is, with these players, trying to show them to play a certain system that there's a very good chance that when they go to their club, when they do get to the senior side, that they'll never use?
My take on that would be... I had a phone call today off a lad that I coached at MK Dons, and he did not suit the style of MK Dons, which was very open, expansive football.
Dele Alli.
It wasn't him. It was his brother. And he used to go on loan to non-league clubs, and when he'd come back, we'd spend time after training hitting channel balls, playing real football, playing lower league style football, because him stepping out as a centre-half and trying to play balls into the midfield, bypassing the midfield with quality, going on little mazy runs, wasn't going to get him a career in football. He was going to get a career in football by playing old-school style football. So I think you've got to give young players a well-rounded view on what they're going to need, full stop. It's very hard, but when they're going bouncing from 15s to 16s to 17s football underage, there has to be some kind of continuity. So it's not, oh my, 15's manager wants me to launch and get second ball, 16 manager. So there has to be that continuity, and there has to be that cohesion within the underage teams.
What if we have an incredibly talented 15-year-old who plays as a number 10? Where's the role for him?
If he's that good, I would base the team around him. If he's head and shoulders above anything else, if he's a Dele Alli who you just mentioned.
Do the coaches in the Ireland underage setup have the power if they have a player like that?
I would imagine so. If they go and have meetings with Rude Doctor and say, look, this number 10 is going to be the next best thing. We need to work the team around. So we're going to play 2 number 6s. We're going to go very, very solid, and we'll let our fullbacks go, or whatever way he wants to tweak it. There's certainly the license to do that within the team. Mm-hmm. Last year, we had 3 very good centre-forwards at under-17 level. And at times, the 2 wide players of the front 3 would play narrow and become, at times, like 3 centre-forwards that we had up there, because we were blessed in that position.
When you're away last summer with the 17s, and when you're watching the 19s and the 16s, technically, can those players play out from the back? Can the goalkeeper roll it out to the fullback?
100%. With ease.
So
with
why
confidence.
Can't... Where do they lose that along the way?
We don't know yet, because they haven't got there, have they? I don't know what the 15s and 16s were like a few years ago. But with the English teams that we're seeing at the moment, the success they're having at underage level, there's such a huge jump. There's a lot of things can happen between now and 2, 3, 4 years. But in terms of ability-wise, you put our 16s, 17s and 18s, who I seen a lot of last year, you put those squads together and that pool of players, some outstandingly talented players in that group.
Yeah, I think, I mean, Kev's made the point here, I think, over the last couple of nights, that it's just you can't replicate the pressure maybe that you get in a senior scenario in... That you might play at underage or for the small crowds and so on. But I guess the point is, you mentioned 2020 could be a struggle. Look, what do we do now? We're getting to the stage where there is a transitional phase coming. There may be 4 or 5 players leave the squad. it's a very important campaign because the games are in Dublin. But do you, not quite write off a campaign, but can you afford to spend the time bringing in four or five players at once so that they're comfortable, so that their debut isn't a scenario where they're the only player coming into a game with the weight of the world on their shoulders? I mean, is that possible to create that transitional phase within a competitive cycle?
I don't think we can swallow this campaign because it's that important. The games will be in Dublin. And I don't think there's the players of the age to really come into the squad yet, to my knowledge. You mentioned Josh Cunningham, Declan Rice. Declan Rice would certainly be one that I would have a look at and maybe fast track him. I would stick with Martin 100% for the next campaign. And I would... Look, I'm pragmatic in my approach. If I was setting up an Ireland team as a coach or as a manager, I would be similar to Martin in terms of that style that we've seen in Copenhagen. Like what I said, in terms of higher up the pitch, with a real emphasis on transition to attack, counter-attacking football. Look, at times, we know we need to be better, and the player, but I would be instilling that in the training ground day in, day out with them. After 2020, then I would readdress it, because the World Cup is going to be when our seedings, it's obviously going to be very difficult again. Because we've done really well overall in the campaign. I think we've done really well to finish where we did, because I certainly didn't see it halfway through. So overall, I felt it was a success. We've no divine right to be playing in a World Cup, but it's the way that it ended is obviously not going to sit well with everybody.
So you say O'Neill should be given the extra 2 years, but Tuesday night was the most important qualification campaign game Martin O'Neill faced during his time, leaving the actual Euros aside, the most important game he had set up a team for. And you said the tactics were clueless, absolutely clueless. If he can't get the tactics right for a game of that importance, why should we trust him with this young Irish talent that's coming through for the next 2 years?
I don't think there's lots of talent coming through in the next 2 years. And I think he's going to have to be clever. He's going to have to be shrewd in the way he goes about it. I do think that the tactics were terrible today night. And I would say privately, he would know that. I think it's fairly evident. It's there to see. But that was one night, and I'm not judging him on 90 minutes of football. I'm judging him what he's done over the last 4 years as the Ireland manager. And overall, a little bit like him, a lot of people would have said I would have been biased towards Trapp. Trapp's era, for me, was a success in Irish football. To date, Martin's is still a success for me, because we don't have a divine right to finish in those places, to be playing at a World Cup. The other night was a disaster.
I haven't spoken to Tony O'Donoghue, so I'm not quite sure with his very last question what he was getting at with Martin O'Neill when he brought up the Germany 6-1 with Trapattoni. The sense after that 6-1, the game you were playing in, was that Trapattoni should have gone then, that the fans had fallen out of love with the team, that the players weren't happy. Everybody seemed to know that really we should have ended it there. There were probably financial issues, all that. And he stayed a year longer, and it was a lost campaign. Now, I don't feel that there's quite that negativity towards O'Neill, but it is still 18 months before we have a qualifier where your last competitive game is a 5-1 home defeat. And any little setback in friendlies or this Nations League, and suddenly the pressure is quite intense. And as spiky as O'Neill is, I wonder, does he fancy that?
Yeah, it does. It chips away at the credit in the bank. And as Keith says about Trapp's time being a success, and I definitely think you could argue that point, but he probably stayed a campaign too long. And maybe the fear is that the players have had a certain voice and a certain way of doing things for 4 years, which is a good stint. And maybe there's a natural sense that they just need that freshening up. But there is this debate. We had a slight discussion about this earlier on. Does O'Neill himself want to stay? Does he look at this transitional phase that Keith has laid out there? You look at the squad, you look at the players and think, like, within the Irish job, he's still well sort of viewed. I think that the perception of what he's done in the UK is quite positive. Does he want to suffer 2 years of maybe difficult results, maybe for reasons that are out of his hands, and then all of a sudden where does he go from now? It is a point, you just wonder, with the vibes maybe not being great, that friendly results in March and June, there might be more scrutiny and focus on them if you see a team with younger players still lacking the direction that they were lacking the other night.
Just quickly before we leave Ireland, Wes, Walters, O'Shea, Murphy, Whelan, do you expect that's the last we've seen of all of them in an Ireland jersey?
Yeah, probably. I'd be surprised if any of those stay on. Maybe Daryl Murphy might get persuaded, just because we don't have many of the options in that pitch. But yeah, I would be surprised any of those are playing next time out.
We should have a testimonial for Wes, where Wes gets to play the full 90 minutes at the Aviva. A Wes-timonial.
Jesus, you've stumbled onto something
there. A Wes-timonial at the Aviva, where we all just give him a standing ovation for the entire game. He plays as the number 10. Plays as the number 10.
He could take it off after an hour. He could take it off after an hour.
I think it's an idea. I think it's definitely a good idea. We'll have a Wes-timonial to celebrate the great man. All right. Will you stick with us for a few minutes?
Yeah, no bother.
Good man. We're going to talk to Graeme Hunter in a moment.
Off the Ball on News Talk.
In association with the Air Sport app, allowing you to cast your favourite sporting action from your tablet or mobile phone straight to your TV.
Oh, it's good to talk about something that's not Ireland. Good evening, Graeme.
Yeah, let's just not go there, either of us.
I won't even ask for your opinion on saving the soul of Irish football.
I watched one of your studio guests tonight, talking really intelligently and interestingly about it last night. When football, however painful it is, when football's well analysed and well explained, then it makes it all the more interesting. It doesn't ease any of your pain, but listen, Scotland, were there. We were there first for you. We took a bullet for you first. Eh?
Dan is delighted with that compliment.
It might have been about someone else.
It was Dan. Sorry if I didn't make that clear, Keith.
How are things in Barcelona at the moment? Obviously, it's been
beautiful,
an international break.
Very
so
near the sea. It's sweet. The living is good, if that's what you're after.
The political situation, most of the leaders from Catalonia currently in prison. Are people still talking football? Does football seem as important as it usually is?
Yes, because it's an obsession. I think if you were to deliver that sort of thought differently, has everything else been exhausted out of conversation? Are people genuinely worried about the drop in trade? Are people genuinely worried about the drop in tourism? Of all the demonstrations, of all the marches since I've been in this city, which is nearly 16 years now, possibly the most impressive was 1 million people last weekend simply demonstrating for the release of these political prisoners, for democracy, for liberty, fairness, demonstrating all creatures great and small, every class, every age, every type of person, peacefully again, but articulately. Football hasn't dropped off the radar, no, absolutely it hasn't. And Barcelona keep issuing what I personally think, and I'm not a Catalan, clear, articulate, balanced statements. I think there are many in the community who want them to be radical, who want more stentorian words. But for the moment, I don't think that's Football Club Barcelona's position. I'm hearing in any of the media, is trying to say a good Barcelona, a successful Barcelona can take people's minds off this. Nobody is making that kind of asinine comparison. But, you know, football is a total obsession here, and therefore it's probably the one thing that hasn't dropped off the radar.
We do have the first Madrid derby of the year this Saturday, Atletico against Real at Atletico's new stadium. Should we expect a display of rampant nationalism from the two sets of supporters?
Not when there are no independentistas to aim it at. I don't think so. You're going to get that wherever now, in my opinion, given the numbers of demonstrations and marches all around Spain that have been pushing the other angle, that Spain must be unified, that the national flag must be flown. Therefore, every city that the Football Club Barcelona go to, even though there's nobody there at that club or on the playing squad who's been noisily asking for independence. A referendum, democracy, dialogue, yes. But nonetheless, Football Club Barcelona, for whatever reasons, will be identified as somebody who can be an entity that can be booed, that can be targeted. And therefore, as they travel, they will find it difficult. But they're going to Leganés tomorrow lunch or tomorrow mid-afternoon, Barca. To the Jack in the Box team of the La Liga season, without any question whatsoever. It's in the suburbs of Madrid. It's a small stadium, but they will find a hostile welcome for them there. And when they travel to Valencia for the Mestalla, for what promises, even given what's coming on Saturday night, the Madrid derby, even given the Clásico on the 23rd of December, right now in my mind, in terms of football, Barca at the Mestalla, in I think a week's time, portrays as being epic in football terms, but also the Mestalla is a stadium, and that part of Valencia is a place whereby we will see the most virulent demonstration of Spanish nationalism from the stands towards Barcelona, I think. But it's still the football in that game that attracts me. And if you go back to the Madrid derby, it means that it's a hell of a place for La Liga, the Spanish capital, this weekend, given that Barca must go to Leganés. And if they win, they can sit back and look at these two, you know, pecking the eyes out of each other.
11 points clear if they win.
If you're talking about Real Madrid in particular, because Atleti, I believe strongly, don't have the capacity to win the title. Haven't had. Won't do when they get their reinforcements, which means Vitolo and Diego Costa at minimum from January 1. But Madrid do have the resources to win the title. I still think that if the point gap can be 8 points coming out of this weekend, Madrid, in my mind, are not out of it and can win. Three teams, two clubs, have overturned an 8-point gap on a leader. Madrid never have, but the squad does have the capacity. So you're right. Atleti can't lose because the inquest will be gigantic. They're horrible in the Champions League. They've lost their personality, where once everything was tight and they had their hand around your throat if they were playing you. Now it's lax. There's space. If you look at the Carabag goal in the Champions League, the draw at home at the Metropolitano, which effectively has left Atleti needing a minor miracle to go through in the Champions League. This is the finalist of a couple of the last three seasons. If you look at the space that they exploited there, Nathan, it's extraordinary. The difference in Atleti. And therefore, a defeat at home to Madrid will lead to the biggest inquest there has been at Atleti since Kike Sanchez Flores left and since we saw Cholo Simeone nearly 6 years ago coming in. And effectively, I look at it and say Madrid have to win to stay in touch for the title. They have problems everywhere. They have players nearly fit. The gigantic risk of if Kehler right, can Carvajal come back at full back? I don't think so. I don't see it that way. And their form has been poor and they aren't scoring goals. So the inquest for the defeated will be gigantic on Sunday. But right now, the tantalising thing is that one of them can lay down a claim and say, we're gonna stay on Barca's heels. And should Leganés do something extraordinary on Saturday afternoon, then the Madrid derby becomes bigger still.
Looking at Real, you mentioned the goal scoring. One goal for Ronaldo in the league so far this season. One goal for Karim Benzema. Benzema saying his game isn't all about goals, that he's changed his game. The pressure that's come on Zidane, did the international break come at a good time for him and for the group, considering there were some reports of Ronaldo and Ramos getting in each other's throats, a little bit of tension within the camp? Did the international break and those players getting a little bit of time away from Madrid, did it come at a good time?
I think for other reasons, completely different reasons, because effectively the only thing that's genuinely problematic for Real Madrid is that not only have they got right now, and you might throw back at me that many big squads around Europe suffer this problem, not only right now are they missing vital men, key men, that make all the difference. Looking at Kehler, looking at Bale, looking at Carvajal, and Bale's season before he became injured had been fabulous. The impact of him on this team, irrespective of him being called out for being made of crystal and all this kind of rubbish, as he was firing for this team, it was making a gigantic difference. Kehler is better than Kiko Casilla in goals. Carvajal, you talked about the goal problems, Benzema and Ronaldo. Without them, Bale, when he was playing, was setting up goals for Ronaldo as well, scoring them. But the key thing is, just cast all three of you, your minds back to last season, when Madrid looked unstoppable. Whether they were playing well or not, they looked unstoppable. And there were often five men up front, three strikers, say Isco moving in from the midfield to play either just behind them or with them, and one or both of the fullbacks playing as wingers, not wingbacks, Marcelo and Carvajal, and supplying. And that's gone. Marcelo's been off form, has been injured. Carvajal, there's virus that affected his heart. He's better. He's fit. He talked recently this week about thinking genuinely, this virus that came from nowhere and attacked the lining of his heart, he thought this might finish me. I'm having just signed a new contract, having declared his will to be captain of Madrid in due course, and having had an okay season, suddenly he was faced with the idea that he might not be able to play football anymore. The virus has been defeated. He's nearly fit again. That will change Madrid. So the break came it, at a good time in terms of Kovacic is training again. Kehler is close. Carvajal is close. Marcelo has had time to find some form. It has definitely, I think it's going to prove to have been brilliant for Luka Modric, who has had qualification on his mind, weighing on his mind. It's a debate that you all know. That's been relieved. They relieved that instantly in the first game against Greece. He's going to the World Cup. We're going to see a renewed Modric. That's a big deal. Are they? They're not at running speed. We're not going to see a AAA version of Real Madrid in the derby. They may win. I think they might win. But we're going to see that coming in the next 3, 4, 5 weeks as we build up to the World Cup Championship and then the Clásico on the 23rd.
The atmosphere at a Madrid derby, how does it compare to a Clásico?
Until now, it's been much, much better. Much better. Because the Bernabeu genuinely hates Atleti. And the Calderon, if you ask anybody who's played there, never mind somebody who's played there in red and white, the Calderon was a place that probably was unequalled, apart from unless you were playing in a River Boca game. It was extraordinary, but this is new. This is the debut in this fixture in the Wanda Metropolitano. It's a less hostile place. It's beautifully laid out. It might be reminiscent, I suppose, a little bit of, say, Wembley or Arsenal's new ground compared to Highbury. And it isn't going to be as hostile, isn't going to be as vibrant. There are going to be some Madrid fans there. That's one of the great flaws of La Liga. We don't have the Britain and Ireland idea of travelling supports, guaranteed room for this noisy band from the other side to go with the team and kind of wage vocal war. That doesn't happen, and therefore it has been a great fixture at the Calderon, better than at the Bernabeu. This is new. We're going to find out. Will it be as hostile? It definitely won't. And that just strips one little extra weapon away from Atleti, because you got that. The crowd at the Calderon was the 12th, 13th and sometimes the 14th man too.
Graham, great stuff. We'll talk to you next Thursday.
Enjoy your football, lads.
All right, Keith is still here. Dan as well. We're going to take one more quick break and we will wrap up the football show.
Off the ball.
In association with AIR. Watch 35 live European Rugby Champions Cup games this season on the AIR Sport Pack.
This is News Talk.
Lads, never mind all the moaning about Tony O'Donoghue and Martin O'Neill and the fans and the players all been good at the people. I really feel sorry for the good folk from the Principality of Wales. They missed out only for us to progress and then bow out with a whimper. Somewhere, John Hartson must be punching a hole in the wall. I'm telling it like it is.
Yeah, I mean, I don't feel too sorry for them. But I mean, if they are watching next summer, it will be Ireland that they will be thinking about.
Very quickly, Michael O'Neill, been offered the Sunderland job, turned it down. Should he take the Scotland job?
I thought he should have moved on last year and he kicked on again. He deserves a good job. I'm just not quite sure either those are good jobs.
Is Scotland a good job?
It is location-wise, I suppose, in terms of where he lives.
It's a low bar, though. It's a low bar. I mean, they haven't had success in a while, so...
Yeah. And I think he'd do well for them, but I wouldn't be taking a Sunderland job if I was him.
What glorious... Last time I met you, we were on a flight to Manchester and you were going to Huddersfield and then heading to Middlesbrough.
Yep.
Where's Sky got you going this weekend?
Back in the north. I'm back in the north. The man in the north. I'm going to Preston tomorrow night.
Who are Preston playing?
Bolton.
Oh! Proper old northwest ding dong.
Yeah.
Big one.
Darren Morgan Swansea. Play.
Boyle play.
Boyle, Kevin O'Connor will probably play. Alan Brown will play. Maguire injured is just a sickener for
Killed
him.
Killed him.
Sickener.
Killed
Where are you Saturday?
I'm at Burnley. That's all I'll be seeing.
Who are Burnley playing?
Swansea. Ooh. Big game for Swansea. You're a snob, though. Look at you with your Super Sunday
here,
games.
I've been to...
Look, he thinks he's great.
We are a snob. That's why this Sunday, live and off the ball, we will bring you Watford against West Ham. Dave McIntyre, our friend Clinton Morrison.
Is Clint doing it?
Clinton is there.
And Dave McIntyre is doing it. Because you're not bothered. You're basically, what are you doing on Sunday?
Yeah. Family time.
Yeah.
Watching Watford against West Ham at some stage as well, probably. If you're up early in the morning, OTB AM, make it part of your morning routine. Keith Andrews does every morning when he's in the gym and getting his hair done. It's back on at 7:45 a.m. It'll be Adrian and Owen in studio tomorrow. Ray Parler will be on with the lads. And Kev will be looking ahead to the weekend's football. Tomorrow night, Brian O'Driscoll is going to be in studio. We'll have the crappy quiz. We'll be checking in with Paddy Agnew live from Rome to see if the Italians are even more miserable than we are. And hopefully John Duggan and Don McLean will be able to cheer us all up with a few winning tips in Friday night racing. Keith, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Nathan. Thanks, man. Not really. I'm not going to be honest.
That's fine. Fair enough. Dan, thank you as well. That's us done. Tom Dunn is up next. We'll talk to you tomorrow. Good luck.
Off the ball on News Talk. Thanks to AIR. Catch all the sports you love free on the AIR Sport Pack with AIR Broadband.